Hello, this is Pastor Jimmy Harper. Thanks for listening to this Lee University broadcast. We're excited that you are joining us today for one of our many campus events. We hope that you are encouraged as you listen.
Thank you for having me. Before I get started, I feel like I need to make a confession. Before I was able to even think about preparing for this talk on female empowerment, I had to get with my sister and pick out what I was going to wear. I'm not sure if that says something about female empowerment or about me. I don't know, and that's okay. Sometimes when we talk about women and empowering women, we mistakenly think that maybe there's only one way to be a strong woman. There's lots of ways. You can read fashion magazines. You cannot read fashion magazines. You can wear running shoes. You can wear high heels. You can be a career woman. You can be a mama staying at home with your babies. My husband Mike and I bought Emma, our little girl who's almost four, a book about Betty Lou, a Sesame Street puppet who wants to be president when she grows up. So Emma is very fascinated by the idea of the president. She knows who President Obama is. Last week, she and Mike were watching TV, and they watched part of a speech by the president. And Emma says to her father, "President Obama is a boy, just like you are a boy. Presidents have only been boys." And my husband replies, "Well, not forever. You could be a girl president." And Emma says, "No, I want to be a face painter and a mommy." And I couldn't have been happier. Emma knows when she feels God's yes. She has said for the past year and a half that she wants to be a face painter. And she's always coloring because I told her that's what you have to do to prepare for that profession. That's all that I could ever hope for, that she lives in God's yes. God's yes is a phrase I picked up from a poem that a professor here at Lee sent me when I was a student. I asked God if it was okay to be melodramatic. She said yes. I asked her if it was okay to be short. She said, "It sure is." I asked her if I could wear nail polish or not wear nail polish. And she said, "Honey," she calls me that sometimes, she said, "you can do just exactly what you want to." "Thanks, God," I said. "And is it okay if I don't paragraph my letters?" "Sweet cakes," God said. Who knows where she picked that up? What I'm telling you is yes, yes, yes. How do you feel God saying yes to you? When do you feel God saying yes to you? I'm going to share a little about my work with women and children in Africa, how we empower them to hear that, yes, you are strong, you are capable, you are worthwhile, and to act on it. As you listen, I also want you to be thinking about God saying yes to you. There's a girl whose family we work with in Rwanda. I know that this photo up here isn't that clear, but don't you still see her spirit shining through? The first time I saw this little girl's photo, I felt God's yes. I felt his joy. There's something sparkling in her eyes. I thought that little girl could conquer the world. When we talk about the people we work with Network for Africa, we usually give them different names to protect their privacy. And I always like to call this little girl Joy, because joy is good news. Her mother is a student in Aspire, a year-long program that Network for Africa supports. Before I tell you the good news, though, I have some bad news. And this is where I'd like to stop and everyone get out a pen and a piece of paper. I'll wait. I'm going to be throwing out a lot of statistics here, and you should not take my word for it. So I want everyone to write this website address down, and I've listed all of the sources that I'll be referencing today. So it's leeiwd2012.blogspot.com. Please read it. Let me know if I got anything wrong. I also want to encourage you to keep talking this week about women in the world. If you're on Twitter and have questions or comments about today or this week, use the hashtag #LeeIWD2012, and I'll try to respond. I neglected to put it up here, but I have a Twitter name just for this, and it's Krista @LeeIWD. So Krista, A.T. Lee, I.W.D. United Nations studies indicate that worldwide, 6 out of every 10 women will experience physical and or sexual violence in her lifetime. In 1994, a World Bank study revealed that for girls and women between 16 and 44 years old, rape and domestic violence is more dangerous than cancer, motor vehicle accidents, war, and malaria. In many conflicts around the world, rape is being used as a weapon. In genocide, such as in Bosnia, Rwanda, and Darfur, it is said that there are two stages. First, they kill the men. Second, they rape the women, which has a twofold purpose. It shames the women, often causing them to be outcast and thus unable to support themselves after the conflict. The rapes are also a method of ethnic cleansing, as the survivors are impregnated by their attackers. Sometimes the third stage of genocide occurs when the women and their babies die of AIDS they got when they were raped. The Democratic Republic of Congo is often referred to as a rape capital of the world. According to a study last year by the American Journal of Public Health, 48 women are raped there every hour. That's almost a woman a minute, a rape a minute. And although rape is being used as a weapon, it isn't limited to that. It isn't limited to conflict. 22% of women across the Congo have been forced by their partners to have sex against their will. Lest these statistics make us think that this is a problem on the other side of the world, though, one of 6 American women will be the victim of an attempted or completed rape during her lifetime. And the violence doesn't necessarily end when the rape does. Women are often shamed by the process of reporting a rape. When the attacker is known to the woman, it can be difficult to get a restraining order and even harder to enforce it. Poet Adrian Rich writes of how many rape survivors feel depicting a scene between a woman and a policeman. You have to confess to him you were guilty of the crime of having been forced. He knows, or thinks he knows, how much you imagined. He knows, or thinks he knows, what you secretly wanted. Perhaps this is why at least half of all rapes go unreported. 1 in 4 American women will experience domestic violence in her lifetime. And at least 40% of violent relationships, sexual assault will also occur. Look around you. These statistics don't know that you're in chapel. That's every 4th woman beaten. Every 6th woman raped or assaulted. This isn't just abstract. This is about your sisters and your friends. Physical and sexual violence are glaring sins of commission. But what about sins of omission against women? The basic human rights that many women are denied. Amartya Sen, a Nobel Prize-winning economist who, I just want to note, is a man, estimates that 107 million girls are missing from the planet. Why? There are various factors, but it pretty much comes down to they just don't get what they need. Sen says, the failure to give women medical care similar to what men get, and to provide them with comparable food and social services, results in fewer women surviving than would be the case if they had equal care. Especially in already poor areas, parents may be less likely to take a girl to the doctor than a boy, or to pay for a daughter to be vaccinated. If food is scarce, it's often the girl that will go hungry. Through this withholding of resources, gendercide has occurred. I know gendercide, a combination of the words gender and genocide, is a strong word, but let me quote Nicholas Kristof, a journalist that I will mention again later. It appears that more girls and women are now missing from the planet precisely because they are female than men were killed on the battlefield in all the wars of the 20th century. This includes World War I, World War II, the Korean War, Vietnam War, precisely because they are female. South Asia is a sobering example. It is one of the worst places in the world to be a woman. 60% of South Asian women of childbearing years are malnourished. From birth, women are given less food and more work than men, and have little or no say in their health care. Because women are viewed to be of so little value, South Asia accounts for nearly half of the world's maternal deaths. When a mother dies, the whole family suffers. And again, especially the daughters, who are the ones who will be expected to take care of the household, dropping out of school to do so. We also know that within 2 years of a South Asian mother's death, her orphan child is 10 times more likely than her or his peers to die. When a woman in Asia does survive childbirth, she may still suffer from an incredibly embarrassing problem, an obstetric fistula. This is very difficult to talk about, and I have to be blunt. A fistula is when a hole occurs between a woman's vagina and her rectum, or between her bladder and her vagina during a difficult childbirth. In the West, fistulas are rare because we have the medical resources to help women in labor. If a baby gets stuck, we have doctors and tools who can help get the baby out. Also, women giving birth in the West are older, but in Asia and Africa, where the fistulas most often occur, they are young teenagers giving birth, and their pelvises just aren't fully developed, making it harder for them to deliver a baby. What a fistula means is that a woman has no control over her bodily wastes. She smells terrible. She leaks urine and feces wherever she goes. She is an outcast. It takes just $300 and 20 minutes to fix a fistula. But the medical resources are few and far between in Africa and Asia. Too often, when help is available, women can't afford it or don't know how to access it. This is a problem around the world. If it's hard to be a woman, it's even harder to be a poor woman. In 2010, Amnesty International wrote a report warning the United States about our maternal mortality rate. That's the number of mothers dying during childbirth. Despite being one of the richest countries in the world, we rank 39th for maternal deaths. In fact, between 1987 and 2006, our maternal death rate more than doubled, even though there was a 30% decline across the world. To be fair, the U.S. spends more on healthcare than any other country and more on maternal services than any other hospital services. Yet women are still dying, a predominant factor being that they can't afford or don't know how or are otherwise prevented from accessing the care that does exist. Fistulas in Africa and healthcare gaps in the U.S., they're not the same thing. But the frustration of women trying to get the resources they need to be healthy is similar. And surely, we can do better. In addition to lack of nutrition and healthcare services, many women and girls face obstacles to education. Women account for 2/3 of the world's illiteracy rate. There are gains being made. Enrollment of children in primary school is increasing globally. But in impoverished places where there's not enough resources to send all the children to school, it's the boys who get to go. There is another very basic problem that keeps girls in poor countries from consistently attending school: getting their period. With no sanitary pads, no extra clothes, no aspirin for cramps, going to school with a period can be difficult. Women make up 70% of those living in poverty. This statistics blew away even me. Only 1% of the world's land is owned by women. Even in countries where they comprise a majority of farmers, women are often barred by social norms, tradition, and sometimes even the law from owning the land. Stripped of this right, a woman is incredibly vulnerable and dependent on others' decisions. All of these factors create a trap from which it is difficult for a woman to escape. UN Women tells us, statistics indicate that women are more likely than men to be poor and at risk of hunger because of the systematic discrimination they face in education, health care, employment, and control of assets. Poverty implications are widespread for women, leaving many without even basic rights such as access to clean drinking water, sanitation, medical care, and decent employment. Being poor can also mean they have little protection from violence and have no role in decision making. In saying all of this, I do want to be really clear that I do not think women are all good and men are all bad. I think that there are a lot of cultural pressures and misinterpretations of religious traditions that shape harmful ways of thinking about gender. In countries where female genital mutilation occurs, it is women who hold the little girls down while they are cut. They've believed lies about what it means to be a good woman, and they submit to community pressure because they see no other options. So, you've made it through the bad news. There is hope, there is good news. The Fistula Foundation, created in 2000, is providing the surgeries that women need to heal and recover from fistulas. It funds 38 facilities in 15 countries. In Ghana, providing personal hygiene products for menstruation reduced absenteeism and dropout rates among girls by half. Domestic violence in the U.S., while still a seriously undermining societal issue, is declining. The increased provision of legal services for abuse survivors and improvements in women's economic status contribute to the improvement. Sexual assault in the U.S. has declined 60% since 1993. It's 2.5 million women who were not assaulted because of the advocacy and support of people and organizations committed to ending sexual violence. Rebecca Tinsley is a former BBC reporter and has interviewed both genocide survivors and warlords in Bosnia and in Africa. Despite the horrors she's recorded, even she has good news. Rebecca says that the testimonies she heard has confirmed that for every act of barbarity in this world, there is a corresponding beautiful act of decency and courage. I met Rebecca Tinsley in 2005 when I heard her speak at a debate in Westminster, London. I began as an intern for Waging Peace, an organization she and her husband started to campaign against the genocide in Darfur. The following summer, I was hired as Waging Peace's first full-time director. While we were pressuring government offices to end the genocide, we also wanted to help the brave people who had survived genocide. So we began Network for Africa. One thing that is unique about Network for Africa is our strong belief that when given the choice, people much prefer a hand up rather than a handout. Africans want to learn, they want to give their kids a better life, and they're willing to work for it, especially the women. Nicholas Kristof, the journalist I mentioned before, wrote a book with his wife, Cheryl Wu Dunn, called Half the Sky, Empowering the World's Women. In the book, Kristof and Wu Dunn point out that, unfortunately, due to culture and just plain bad personal choices, in many poor countries, if you give money to a man, he'll drink it all. If you give it to a woman, she'll feed and educate her children. Again, it's just the difference in gender responsibilities as they've been traditionally viewed in their culture. But that can change. Education and giving a woman a fighting chance at earning her own income can change it. When women are trained in a skill and given or loaned a little capital and then begin turning a profit, all of a sudden people in the community begin to see that the woman has value. A new generation of boys will grow up respecting women and learning the importance of work and taking care of your family. And the women will respect themselves. This is what we've seen happen in Aspire. Aspire is a program that Joy's mother is enrolled in. It is a year-long intensive training course for vulnerable women in Kigali, the capital of Rwanda. There was a genocide in Rwanda in 1994 that killed 1 million people in 100 days, a rate of killing that exceeds even the Holocaust. And when I say killing, the primary weapon was a machete. People were hacked to death, thrown alive into wells, gang-raped, then killed. Some children watched their entire families slaughtered before them. The country has put tremendous effort into rebuilding, but a legacy of trauma remains. This is a backdrop against which Aspire began in 2007. It was started by a woman named Peace. She kept being annoyed by hearing women on the streets in her neighborhood arguing all the time. So she invited them to come talk with her on her veranda, just like a true Southern woman. And she began to find out that the women were barely surviving, living hand to mouth. Most of them were illegally selling items on the street. Some were even prostitutes. Virtually all had experienced violence, either from the genocide or from domestic abuse. Peace is a licensed social worker, and she began talking with the women, telling them about the options they had. She began working with them to teach them basic hygiene and health skills. And almost single-handedly, Peace evolved this meeting into a training program for 50 women. Now the women are also being taught skills they can use to make money. They produce jewelry and handbags. The jewelry is now being sold by Doncaster, a high-end American clothing company. The president of this Aspire Jewelry Co-op is 54. She has 5 children. Her husband is in jail for participating in the genocide. Aspire has changed her life. She says, "I am proud of myself. There is now food on the table, and I have managed to take care of my children. Now that I am earning money, even the shopkeepers have confidence in me. They will give me credit and know that I will pay it back because I am earning money. I have earned respect in the community." They say, "Those are the working women." We've also just launched a child care center on the Aspire campus, so children like Joy can play and learn with other children in a safe, nurturing environment while their mothers work. Network for Africa is now replicating parts of the Aspire program in Pitango, northern Uganda. We're one of only a couple NGOs doing so. The northern Ugandans have been caught up in a civil war for over 20 years. Uganda is the home of the infamous Lord's Resistance Army. The LRA is led by Joseph Kony. You may have heard of him in recent days. Invisible Children recently released a documentary, Kony 2012, about the fight to capture Kony this year after decades of extreme violence. Kony and the LRA are known for their use of child soldiers. Children as young as 6 have been kidnapped by the LRA. Their methods for keeping the children trapped are horrific. They often give the kids drugs, and they force them to commit some awful atrocity to traumatize them into submission. One girl that we work with said she was forced to carry around the decapitated head of a young boy for an entire day. If a child soldier manages to escape the LRA and return home, she or he often encountered great hostility from their former neighbors and friends. The LRA may have forced the child to kill people back in the village. Understandably, it's difficult for everyone when that child then comes home. Girls who were abducted were forced to serve as sex slaves and sometimes bore their attackers' children. They too are ostracized back in their villages, but they have nowhere else to go. A word that I keep using is trauma, yet mental health is only beginning to be addressed in many of these communities. If progress is going to be sustainable, mental health must be addressed. To do this, Network for Africa has brought psychotherapists from America to Pitango since 2008. The therapists meet with local volunteer leaders at least twice a year to offer both trauma counseling and counseling training so that local leaders can serve as lay counselors. The counselors are able to help communities process the return of these child soldiers so that they will no longer be ostracized, but will again be active members of their villages. Network for Africa bought bicycles so the lay counselors can reach more people, and our greatest problem has been keeping up with the demand. We've also held special training sessions on women's rights. We did this after we were approached by a village elder, a 70-year-old man, who came to us and said, "Please help us. We are destroying our women. The men are not treating them well, and they are not able to take care of their families." Because of this one 70-year-old man in his standing up in his community, we were able to do things with the women that would have never been possible without his support, offering them hope. And this is the most important thing that Network for Africa does. We help connect women with people in their community who tell them they're worth something. And that makes all the difference. You'll have to excuse me. The Claritin D I'm taking makes my mouth dry. And what about the United States? Any good news here? Yes, I'm looking at it. You are the good news. You can make a positive difference. As Christians, we have a powerful message that can change the world. It's found in Genesis 1:27. God created people in his image. Male and female, he created them. I like the Message translation. God created human beings reflecting God's nature. He created them male and female. Jesus says that what we do to those who are outcast, disenfranchised, without power, is what we do to him. He thus cast his lot with women who have historically been on the outside of power. I imagine Jesus gently touching the hand of the woman trapped in an abusive relationship, telling her, "You're worth more than this." I imagine Jesus reassuring the rape survivor, "You did nothing to deserve this." When I was 15, I was like a lot of young women, dealing with confidence issues and body issues. I was conflicted about women's role in the church and in society. One Sunday, I heard two adults, Christians, mocking how shrill women were in talking about their rights. They thought everything was just fine, and it was only strident, bossy, bad women who would ask questions. I had a lot of questions. What did that say about me? After hearing this exchange, I went home and cried, and as passionate teenagers are wont to do, I wrote a poem. Part of it goes, "I am beautiful, though I do not believe it myself, but I must be, for God made the stars, and they shine, and I know his hand made me." I think that we intuitively know when something doesn't match up with our having been made in God's image. When someone belittles or denies God within us, we know. Now, if someone does it long enough, we might begin to believe them. But I don't think the spark of God within us ever goes out. That's why we have women in Uganda who were kidnapped when they were 10 years old, raped for years, and still somehow manage to survive, to escape, to come back home, and against ridicule and discrimination, fight for a better life for themselves, for respect and dignity. It is a spark of God within them. It is God's yes to them that dares them to believe that maybe, just maybe, they are valuable. They are beautiful. When does God say yes to you? Where is the spark of God inside leading you? These are your questions to answer. I'll leave you with a quote by Marianne Williamson. "Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small does not serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We are all meant to shine, as children do. We were born to make manifest the glory of God that is within us." Yes, and amen.